Excuse me? The bartender said. Nothing, Miller said, pushing the half-empty bottle across the bar. Thanks. In his hole, Miller turned on some music. The lyrical chants that Candace had liked. Back when they were young and, if not hopeful, at least more joyful in their fatalism. He set the lights to half power, hoping that if he relaxed, if for just a few minutes he let go of the gnawing sense that he had missed some critical detail, the missing piece might arrive on its own. He'd half expected Candace to appear in his mind, sighing and looking crossly at him the way she had in life. Instead, he found himself talking with Julie Mao. In the half-sleep of alcohol and exhaustion, he imagined her sitting at Havelock's desk. She was the wrong age, younger than the real woman would be. She was the age of the smiling kid in her picture, the girl who had raced in the Razorback and won. He had the sense of asking her questions, and her answers had the power of revelation. Everything made sense. Not only the change in the Golden Bough Society and her own abduction case, but Havelock's transfer, the dead ice hauler, Miller's own life and work. He dreamed of Julie Mao laughing, and he woke up late, with a headache. Havelock was waiting at his desk. His broad, short, earther face seemed strangely alien, but Miller tried to shake it off. You look like crap, Havelock said. Busy night?
Just getting old and drinking cheap beer, Miller said.
One of the vice squad shouted something angry about her files being locked again, and a computer tech scuttled across the station house like a nervous cockroach. Havelock leaned closer, his expression grave. Seriously, Miller, Havelock said. We're still partners, and honest to God, I think you may be the only friend I've got on this rock. You can trust me. If there's anything you want to tell me, I'm good.
That's great, Miller said. But I don't know what you're talking about. Last night was a bust.
No OPA?
Sure, OPA. Any more, you swing a dead cat in this station, you'll hit three OPA guys. Just no good information.
Havelock leaned back, lips pressed thin and bloodless. Miller's shrug asked a question, and the earther nodded toward the board. A new homicide topped the list. At 3 in the morning, while Miller had been having inchoate dream conversations, someone had opened Mateo Judd's hole and fired a shotgun cartridge full of ballistic gel into his left eye.
Well, Miller said, called that one wrong.
Which one? Havelock said.
OPA is not moving in on the criminals, Miller said. They're moving in on the cops.
Chapter 11. Holden. The Doniger was ugly. Holden had seen pictures and videos of the old ocean-going navies of Earth, and even in the Age of Steel, there had always been something beautiful about them. Long and sleek, they had the appearance of something leaning into the wind, a creature barely held in the leash. The Doniger had none of that. Like all long-flight spacecraft, it was built in the office tower configuration. Each deck, one floor of the building, ladders or elevators running down the axis. Constant thrust took the place of gravity. But the Doniger actually looked like an office building on its side. Square and blocky, with small bulbous projections in seemingly random places. At nearly 500 meters long, it was the size of a 130-story building. Alex had said it was 250,000 tons dry weight, and it looked heavier. Holden reflected, not for the first time, on how so much of the human sense of aesthetics had been formed in a time when sleek objects cut through the air. The Doniger would never move through anything thicker than interstellar gas, so curves and angles were a waste of space. The result was ugly. It was also intimidating. As Holden watched from his seat next to Alex in the cockpit of the Knight, the massive battleship matched course with them, looming close and then seeming to stop above them. A docking bay opened, breaking up the Doniger's flat black belly with a square of dim red light. The Knight beeped insistently, reminding him of the targeting lasers painting their hull. Holden looked for the point defense cannons aimed at him. He couldn't find them. When Alex spoke, Holden jumped.
"Roger that, Doniger," the pilot said. "We've got steering lock. I'm killing thrust."
The last shreds of weight vanished. Both ships were still moving at hundreds of kilometers a minute, but their matched courses felt like stillness.
"Got docking permission, Cap. Take her in."
"It seems late to make a run for it, Mr. Kamal," Holden said. He imagined Alex making a mistake that the Doniger interpreted as threatening, and the point defense cannons throwing a couple 100,000 Teflon-coated chunks of steel through them.
"Go slowly, Alex," he said.
"They say one of those can kill a planet," Naomi said over the comm. She was at the op station a deck below.
"Anyone can kill a planet from orbit," Holden replied. "You don't even need bombs. Just push anvils out the airlock. That thing out there could kill... shit, anything."
Tiny touches shifted them as the maneuvering rockets fired. Holden knew that Alex was guiding them in, but he couldn't shake the feeling that the Doniger was swallowing them. Docking took nearly an hour. Once the Knight was inside the bay, a massive manipulator arm grabbed her and put it down in an empty section of the deck. Clamps grabbed the ship, the Knight's hull reverberating with a metallic bang that reminded Holden of a brig cell's maglocks. The Martians ran a docking tube from one wall and mated up to the Knight's airlock. Holden gathered the crew at the inner door.
"No guns, no knives, no anything that might look like a weapon," he said. "They'll probably be okay with hand terminals, but keep them turned off just in case. If they ask for it, hand it over without complaint. Our survival here may rest on them thinking we're very compliant."
"Yeah," Amos said. "Fuckers killed McDowell, but we have to act nice."
Alex started to respond, but Holden cut him off.
"Alex, you did 20 flying with the MCRN. Anything else we should know?"
"Same stuff you said, boss," Alex replied. "Yes, sir, no, sir, and snap to when given an order. The enlisted guys will be okay, but the officers get the sense of humor trained out of them."
Holden looked at his tiny crew, hoping he hadn't killed them all by bringing them here. He cycled open the lock, and they drifted down the short docking tube in the zero-G. When they reached the airlock at the end, flat gray composites and immaculately clean, everyone pushed down to the floor. Their magnetic boots grabbed on. The airlock closed and hissed at them for several seconds before opening into a larger room with about a dozen people standing in it. Holden recognized Captain Teresa Yao. There were several others in naval officer's dress who were part of her staff. One man in an enlisted uniform with a look of thinly veiled impatience, and six Marines in heavy combat armor, carrying assault rifles. The rifles were pointed at him, so Holden put up his hands.
"We're not armed," he said, smiling and trying to look harmless.
The rifles didn't waver, but Captain Yao stepped forward.
"Welcome aboard the Doniger," she said. "Chief, check them."
The enlisted man clumped toward them and quickly and professionally patted them all down. He gave the thumbs up to one of the Marines. The rifles went down, and Holden worked hard not to sigh with relief.
"What now, Captain?"
Holden asked, keeping his voice light. Yao looked Holden over critically for several seconds before answering. Her hair was pulled tightly back, the few strands of gray making straight lines. In person, he could see the softening of age at her jaw and the corners of her eyes. Her stony expression had the same quiet arrogance that all the naval captains he'd known shared. He wondered what she saw, looking at him. He resisted the urge to straighten his greasy hair. "Chief Gunderson will take you down to your rooms and get you settled in," she replied. "Someone will be along shortly to debrief you." Chief Gunderson started to lead them from the room when Yao spoke again, her voice suddenly hard. "Mr. Holden, if you know anything about the 6 ships that are following you, speak now," she said. "We gave them a 2-hour deadline to change course about an hour ago. So far they haven't. In 1 hour, I'm going to order a torpedo launch. If they're friends of yours, you could save them a great deal of pain." Holden shook his head emphatically.
"All I know is they came out of the belt when you started out to meet us, Captain," Holden said. "They haven't talked to us. Our best guess is they're concerned citizens of the belt coming to watch what happens."
Yao nodded. If she found the thought of witnesses disconcerting, it didn't show. "Take them below, Chief," she said, then turned away. Chief Gunderson gave a soft whistle and pointed at one of the 2 doors. Holden's crew followed him out, the Marines bringing up the rear. As they moved through the Doniger, Holden took his first really up-close look at a Martian capital ship. He'd never served on a battleship in the UN Navy, and he'd stepped foot on them maybe 3 times in 7 years, always in dock and usually for a party. Every inch of the Doniger was just a little sharper than any UN vessel he'd served on. "Mars really does build them better than we do."
"Goddamn, Exo, they sure do keep their shit squeaky clean," Amos said behind him. "Ain't much to do on a long flight for most of the crew, Amos," Alex said. "So when you aren't doing something else, you clean."
"See, that's why I work haulers," Amos said. "Clean decks or get drunk and screw, and I've got a preference."
As they walked through a maze of corridors, the ship started a slight vibration, and gravity slowly reappeared. They were under thrust. Holden used his heels to touch his boot slide controls, turning the magnets off. They saw almost no one, and the few they did see moved fast and said little, barely sparing them a glance. With 6 ships closing on them, everyone would be at their duty stations. When Captain Yao had said she'd fire her torpedoes in an hour, there hadn't been a hint of threat in her voice. It was just a flat statement of fact. For most of the young sailors on this ship, it would probably be the first time they'd ever been in a live combat situation, if it came to that. Holden didn't believe it would. He wondered what to make of the fact that Yao was prepared to take out a handful of belt ships just because they were running quiet and close. It didn't suggest that they'd hesitate to kill a water hauler like the Cant if they thought there was reason to. Gunderson brought them to a stop in front of a hatch with OQ-117 printed on it. He slid a card through the lock and gestured everyone inside.
"Better than I'd expected," Shed said, sounding impressed.
The compartment was large by ship standards. It had 6 high-G couches and a small table with 4 chairs stuck to the deck with magnetic feet. An open door in one bulkhead showed a smaller compartment with a toilet and sink. Gunderson and the Marine Lieutenant followed the crew inside.
"This is your rack for the time being," the chief said. "There's a comm panel on the wall. 2 of Lieutenant Kelly's people will be stationed outside. Buzz them and they'll send for anything you need."
"How about some chow?" Amos said.
"We'll have some set up. You are to remain here until called for,"
Gunderson said. Lieutenant Kelly, you have anything to add, sir?
The Marine lieutenant looked them over.
The men outside are there for your protection, but they will react unpleasantly if you make any trouble, he said. You read me?
Loud and clear, Lieutenant, Holden said.
Don't worry. My people will be the easiest house guests you've ever had.
Kelly nodded at Holden with what seemed like genuine gratitude. He was a professional doing an unpleasant job. Holden sympathized. Also, he'd known enough Marines to know how unpleasant it could get if they felt challenged.
Gunderson said, Can you take Mr. Holden here to his appointment on your way out, LT? I'd like to get these folks squared away.
Kelly nodded and took Holden's elbow.
Come with me, sir, he said.
Where am I going, Lieutenant?
Lieutenant Lopez asked to see you as soon as you landed. I'm taking you to him.
Shed looked nervously from the Marine to Holden and back. Naomi nodded.
They'd all see each other again, Holden told himself. He even thought it was likely to be true.
Kelly led Holden at a brisk pace through the ship. His rifle was no longer at the ready, but hanging from his shoulder loosely. Either he decided Holden wasn't going to cause trouble, or that he could take him down easily if he did.
Can I ask who Lieutenant Lopez is?
He's the guy who asked to see you, Kelly said. Kelly stopped at a plain gray door, rapped once, then took Holden inside a small compartment with a table and two uncomfortable-looking chairs. A dark-haired man was setting up a recorder. He waved one hand vaguely in the direction of a chair. Holden sat. The chair was even less comfortable than it looked.
You can go, Mr. Kelly,
the man Holden assumed was Lopez said. Kelly left and closed the door. When Lopez had finished, he sat down across the table from Holden and reached out one hand. Holden shook it.
I'm Lieutenant Lopez.
Kelly probably told you that. I work for Naval Intelligence, which he almost certainly didn't tell you.
My job isn't secret, but they train jarheads to be tight-lipped.
Lopez reached into his pocket, took out a small packet of white lozenges and popped one into his mouth. He didn't offer one to Holden.
Lopez's pupils contracted to tiny points as he sucked the lozenge.
Focus drugs. He'd be watching every tick of Holden's face during questioning. Tough to lie to.
First Lieutenant James R. Holden of Montana, he said.
It wasn't a question.
Yes, sir, Holden said anyway.
7 years in the UNN, last posting on the destroyer Zhangfei.
That's me.
Your file says you were busted out for assaulting a superior officer, Lopez said. That's pretty cliche, Holden. You punched the old man? Seriously?
No, I missed. Broke my hand on a bulkhead.
How'd that happen?
It was quicker than I expected, Holden replied.
Why'd you try?
I was projecting my self-loathing onto him.
It's just a stroke of luck that I actually wound up hurting the right person, Holden said.
Sounds like you've thought about it some since then, Lopez said, his pinprick pupils never moving from Holden's face.
Therapy?
Lots of time to think on the Canterbury, Holden replied.
Lopez ignored the obvious opening and said,
What did you come up with during all that thinking?
The Coalition has been stepping on the necks of the people out here for over 100 years now. I didn't like being the boot.
An OPA sympathizer, then, Lopez said,
his expression not changing at all.
No, I didn't switch sides. I stopped playing. I didn't renounce my citizenship. I like Montana. I'm out here because I like flying, and only a belter rust trap like the Canterbury will hire me.
Lopez smiled for the first time.
You're an exceedingly honest man, Mr. Holden.
Yes.
Why did you claim that a Martian military vessel destroyed your ship?
I didn't. I explained all that in the broadcast.
It had technology only available to inter-planet fleets, and I found a piece of MCRN hardware in the device that tricked us into stopping.
We'll want to see that.
You're welcome to it. Your file says you were the only child of a family co-op, Lopez said, asking as though they'd never stopped talking about Holden's past.
Yes, 5 fathers, 3 mothers.
So many parents for only one child, Lopez said, slowly unwrapping another lozenge. The Martians had lots of space for traditional families. The tax break for 8 adults only having one child allowed them to own 22 acres of decent farmland. There are over 30 billion people on Earth. 22 acres is a national park, Holden said. Also, the DNA mix is legit. They aren't parents in name only.
How did they decide who carried you?
Mother Elise had the widest hips.
Lopez popped the second lozenge into his mouth and sucked on it a few moments. Before he could speak again, the deck shook. The video recorder jiggled on its arm.
Torpedo launches? Holden said. Guess those belt ships didn't change course.
Any thoughts about that, Mr. Holden?
Just that you seem pretty willing to kill belt ships.
You've put us in a position where we can't afford to seem weak. After your accusations, there are a lot of people who don't think much of us.
Holden shrugged. If the man was watching for guilt or remorse from Holden, he was out of luck. The belt ships had known what they were going toward. They hadn't turned away. But still, something bothered him.
They might hate your living guts, Holden said, but it's hard to find enough suicidal people to crew 6 ships. Maybe they think they can outrun torpedoes.
Lopez didn't move. His whole body preternaturally still with the focus drugs pouring through him.
We, Lopez began, and the general quarters klaxon sounded. It was deafening in the small metal compartment.
Holy shit, did they shoot back? Holden asked.
Lopez shook himself like a man waking up from a daydream. He got up and hit the comm button by the door. A Marine came through seconds later.
Take Mr. Holden back to his quarters, Lopez said, then left the room at a run.
The Marine gestured at the corridor with the barrel of his rifle. His expression was hard.
It's all fun and games till someone shoots back, Holden thought.
Naomi patted the empty couch next to her and smiled.
Did they put slivers under your fingernails? She asked.
No, actually. He was surprisingly human for a naval intelligence wonk, Holden replied. Of course, he was just getting warmed up.
Have you guys heard anything about the other ships?
Alex said,
Nope, but that alarm means they're taking them seriously all of a sudden.
It's insane, Shed said quietly. Flying around in these metal bubbles, and then trying to poke holes in each other. You ever see what long-term decompression and cold exposure does? Breaks all the capillaries in your eyes and skin. Tissue damage to the lungs can cause massive pneumonia followed by emphysema-like scarring. I mean, if you don't just die.
Well, that's awful fucking cheerful, Doc. Thanks for that, Amos said.
The ship suddenly vibrated in a syncopated but ultra-high-speed rhythm. Alex looked at Holden, eyes wide.
That's the point defense network opening up. That means incoming torpedoes, he said. Better strap in tight, kids. The ship might start doing some violent maneuvering.
Everyone but Holden was already belted into the couches. He fastened his restraints, too.
This sucks. All the real action is happening thousands of clicks from here, and we got no instruments to look at, Alex said. We won't know if something slipped through the flak screen till it rips the hull open.
Boy, everybody is just a fucking pile of fun right now, Amos said loudly.
Shed's eyes were wide, his face too pale. Holden shook his head.
Not going to happen, he said. This thing is unkillable. Whoever those ships are, they can put on a good show, but that's it.
All respect, Captain, Naomi said. But whoever those ships are, they should be dead already. And they aren't. The distant noises of faraway combat kept up. The occasional rumble of a torpedo firing, the near-constant vibration of the high-speed point-defense guns. Holden didn't realize he'd fallen asleep until he was jerked awake by an ear-splitting roar. Amos and Alex were yelling. Shed was screaming.
What happened? Holden yelled over the noise. We're hit, Cap, Alex said. That was a torpedo hit.
The gravity suddenly dropped away. The Doniger had stopped its engines, or they'd been destroyed. Amos was still yelling, shit, 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 over everything, but at least Shed had stopped screaming. He was staring wide-eyed out of his couch, his face white. Holden unbuckled his straps and pushed off toward the comm panel.
Jim, Naomi called out, what are you doing?
We need to find out what's going on,
Holden said over his shoulder. When he reached the bulkhead by the hatch, he punched the comm panel call button. There was no reply. He hit it again, then started pounding on the hatch. No one came.
Where are our damn Marines? He said.
The lights dimmed, came back up, then again and again in a slow cadence.
Gauss turret's firing. Shit, it's CQB.
Alex said in awe. In the history of the Coalition, no capital ship had ever gotten into a close-quarters battle. But here they were, firing the ship's big cannons, which meant that the range was sufficiently short that a non-guided weapon was viable. Hundreds or even dozens of kilometers, not thousands. Somehow, the Belt ships had survived Doniger's torpedo barrage.
Anyone else think this is desperate fucking queer?
Amos asked, a touch of panic in his voice. The Doniger began to ring like a gong, struck over and over again by a massive hammer. Return fire. The Gauss round that killed Shed didn't even make a noise. Like a magic trick, two perfectly round holes appeared on either side of the room in a line that intersected Shed's couch. One moment the medic was there. The next, his head was gone from the Adam's apple up. Arterial blood pumped out in a red cloud, pulled into two thin lines, and whirled to the holes in the walls of the room as the air rushed out.
Chapter 12. Miller. For 30 years, Miller had worked security. Violence and death were familiar companions to him. Men, women, animals, kids. Once he'd held a woman's hand while she bled to death. He'd killed 2 people. Could still see them die if he closed his eyes and thought about it. If anyone had asked him, he'd have said there wasn't much left that would shake him. But he'd never watched a war start before. The distinguished Hyacinth Lounge was in the shift change rush. Men and women in security uniforms, mostly from Star Helix, but a few smaller companies too, were either drinking their after-work liquor and winding down, or making trips to the breakfast buffet for coffee, textured fungi and sugar sauce, sausage with meat, maybe 1 part in 1,000. Miller chewed the sausage and watched the display monitor on the wall. A Star Helix external relations head looked sincerely out, his demeanor radiating calm and certainty as he explained how everything was going to hell. Preliminary scans suggest that the explosion was the result of a failed attempt to connect a nuclear device to the docking station. Officials from the Martian government have referred to the incident only as an alleged terrorist action and refused comment pending further investigation. Another one, Havelock said from behind him. You know, eventually one of those assholes is going to get it right. Miller turned in his seat, then nodded to the chair beside him. Havelock sat.
That'll be an interesting day, Miller said. I was about to call you.
Yeah, sorry, his partner said. I was up kind of late.
Any word on the transfer?
No, Havelock said. Figure my paperwork's hung on a desk someplace in Olympus. What about you? Any word on your special project, girl?
Not yet, Miller said. Look, the reason I wanted to meet up before we went in, I need to take a couple of days, try to run down some leads on Julie. With all this other shit going on, Shadid doesn't want me doing much more than phoning this one in.
But you're ignoring that, Havelock said. It wasn't a question.
I've got a feeling about this one.
So how can I help?
I need you to cover for me.
How am I going to do that? Havelock asked. It's not like I can tell them you're sick.
They've got access to your medical record, same as everyone else's.
Tell them I've been getting drunk a lot, Miller said. That Candace came by. She's my ex-wife. Havelock chewed his sausage, brow furrowed. The Earther shook his head slowly, not a refusal, but a prelude to a question. Miller waited.
You're telling me you'd rather have the boss think you're missing work because you're on a dysfunctional, heartbroken bender than that you're doing the work she assigned you? I don't get it.
Miller licked his lips and leaned forward, elbows on the smooth, off-white table. Someone had scratched a design into the plastic, a split circle, and this was a cop bar.
I don't know what I'm looking at, Miller said. There's a bunch of things that belong together somehow, and I'm not sure yet what it is. Until I know more, I need to stay low. A guy has a fling with his ex, hits the bottle for a few days. That's not going to light up anyone's panels.
Havelock shook his head again, this time in mild disbelief. If he'd been a belter, he'd have made the gesture with his hands so you could see it when you had an environment suit on. Another of the 100 small ways someone who hadn't grown up on the belt betrayed himself. The wall monitor cut to the image of a blonde woman in a severe uniform. The external relations head was talking about the Martian Navy's tactical response and whether the OPA was behind the increased vandalism. That was what he called fumbling an overloaded fusion reactor while setting up a ship-killing booby trap. Vandalism.
That shit just doesn't follow, Havelock said.
And for a moment, Miller didn't know if he meant the belter guerrilla actions, the Martian response, or the favor he'd asked.
Seriously, where's Earth? All this shit's going on and we don't hear a damn thing from them.
Why would we? Miller asked. It's Mars and the belt going at it.
When was the last time Earth let anything major happen without them in the middle of it?
Havelock said, then sighed.
Okay, you're too drunk to come in. Your love life's a mess. I'm trying to cover for you.
Just for a couple days.
Make sure you get back before someone decides it's the perfect chance for a random shooting to take out the Earther cop.
I'll do that, Miller said, rising from the table. You watch your back.
Don't need to tell me twice, Havelock said.
The series center for jiu-jitsu was down near the port, where the spin gravity was strongest. The hole was a converted storage space from before the big spin. A cylinder flattened where flooring had been set in about a third of the way from the bottom. Racks bearing various lengths of staffs, bamboo swords, and dull plastic practice knives hung from the vaulted ceiling. The polished stone echoed with the grunting of men working a line of resistance machines,
and the soft thud of a woman at the back punishing a heavy bag. Three students stood on the central mat, speaking in low voices. Pictures filled the front wall on either side of the door. Soldiers in uniform, security agents for half a dozen Belter corporations. Not many inner planet types, but a few. Plaques commemorating placements in competitions. A page of small type outlining the history of the studio. One of the students shouted and collapsed, carrying one of the others to the mat with her. The one still standing applauded and helped them back up. Miller searched through the wall of pictures, hoping to find Julie. "Can I help you?" The man was half a head shorter than Miller and easily twice as broad. It should have made him look like an Earther, but everything else about him said Belt. He wore pale sweats that made his skin seem even darker. His smile was curious, and as serene as a well-fed predator. Miller nodded. "Detective Miller," he said. "I'm with station security. There's one of your students I wanted to get some background on." "This is an official investigation?" the man asked. "Yeah," Miller said. "I'm afraid it is." "Then you'll have a warrant." Miller smiled. The man smiled back. "We don't give out any information on our students without a warrant," he said. "Studio policy." "I respect that," Miller said. "No, I really do. It's just that parts of this particular investigation are maybe a little more official than others. The girl's not in trouble. She didn't do anything. But she has a family on Luna who want her found." "A kidnap job," the man said, folding his arms. The serene face had gone cool, without any apparent movement. "Only the official part," Miller said. "I can get a warrant, and we can do the whole thing through channels, but then I have to tell my boss. The more she knows, the less room I have to move." The man didn't react. His stillness was unnerving. Miller struggled not to fidget. The woman working the heavy bag at the far end of the studio went through a flurry of strikes, shouting out with each one. "Who?" the man asked. "Julie Mao," Miller said. He could have said he was looking for the Buddha's mother for all the reaction he got. "I think she's in trouble." "Why do you care if she is?" "I don't know the answer to that one," Miller said. "I just do. If you don't want to help me, then you don't. And you'll go get your warrant. Do this through channels." Miller took off his hat, rubbed a long, thin hand across his head, and put the hat back in place. "Probably not," he said. "Let me see your ID," the man said. Miller pulled up his terminal and let the man confirm who he was. The man handed it back and pointed to a small door behind the heavy bags. Miller did as he was told. The office was cramped. A small laminate desk with a soft sphere behind it in lieu of a chair, two stools that looked like they'd come out of a bar. A filing cabinet with a small fabricator that stank of ozone and oil that was probably where the plaques and certificates were made. "Why does the family want her?" the man asked, lowering himself onto the sphere. It acted like a chair, but required constant balance. A place to rest without actually resting. "They think she's in harm's way. At least, that's what they're saying. And I don't have reason to disbelieve them yet." "What kind of harm?" "Don't know," Miller said. "I know she was on station. I know she shipped out for Tycho, and after that, I've got nothing." "Her family want her back on their station?" The man knew who her family was. Miller filed the information away without missing a beat. "I don't think so," Miller said.
The last message she got from them routed through Luna.
Down the well. The way he said it made it sound like a disease.
I'm looking for anyone who knows who she was shipping with. If she's on a run, where she was going, and when she was planning to get there. If she's in range of a tight beam.
I don't know any of that, the man said.
You know anyone I should ask?
There was a pause.
Maybe. I'll find what I can for you. Anything else you can tell me about her?
She started at the studio 5 years ago. She was angry when she first came. Undisciplined.
She got better, Miller said.
Brown belt, right? The man's eyebrows rose.
I'm a cop, Miller said. I find things out.
She improved, her teacher said. She'd been attacked, just after she came to the belt. She was seeing that it didn't happen twice.
Attacked, Miller said, parsing the man's tone of voice.
Raped?
I didn't ask.
She trained hard, even when she was off station.
You can tell when people let it slide. They come back weaker.
She never did.
Tough girl, Miller said. Good for her.
Did she have friends? People she sparred with?
A few. No lovers that I know of, since that's the next question.
That's strange. Girl like that.
Like what, detective?
Pretty girl, Miller said.
Competent, smart, dedicated. Who wouldn't want to be with someone like that?
Perhaps she hadn't met the right person. Something in the way he said it hinted at amusement. Miller shrugged, uncomfortable in his skin.
What kind of work did she do? He asked.
Light freighter.
I don't know of any particular cargo. I had the impression that she shipped wherever there was a need.
Not a regular route, then.
That was my impression.
Whose ships did she work?
One particular freighter, or whatever came to hand?
A particular company?
I'll find what I can for you, the man said.
Courier for the OPA?
I'll find out, the man said, what I can.
The news that afternoon was all about Phoebe. The science station there, the one that belters weren't allowed even to dock at, had been hit. The official report stated that half the inhabitants of the base were dead, the other half missing. No one had claimed responsibility yet, but the common wisdom was that some belter group, maybe the OPA, maybe someone else, had finally managed an act of vandalism with a body count. Miller sat in his hole, watching the broadcast feed and drinking. It was all going to hell. The pirate casts from the OPA calling for war, the burgeoning guerrilla actions, all of it. The time was coming that Mars wasn't going to ignore them anymore. And when Mars took action, it wouldn't matter if Earth followed suit. It would be the first real war in the belt. The catastrophe was coming, and neither side seemed to understand how vulnerable they were. And there was nothing, not one single goddamn thing that he could do to stop it. He couldn't even slow it down. Julie Mao grinned at him from the still frame, her pinnace behind her. Attacked, the man had said. There was nothing about it in her record. Might have been a mugging. Might have been something worse. Miller had known a lot of victims, and he put them into three categories. First, there were the ones who pretended nothing had happened, or that whatever it was didn't really matter. That was well over half the people he talked to. Then there were the professionals, people who took their victimization as permission to act out any way they saw fit. That ate most of the rest. Maybe 5%, maybe less, were the ones who sucked it up, learned the lesson, and moved on. The Julies. The good ones. His door chimed 3 hours after his official shift was over. Miller stood up, less steady on his feet than he'd expected. He counted the bottles on the table. There were more than he'd thought. He hesitated for a moment, torn between answering the door and throwing the bottles into the recycler. The door chimed again. He went to open it. If it was someone from the station, they expected him to be drunk anyway. No reason to disappoint. The face was familiar. Acne-pocked, controlled. The OPA armband from the bar. The one who'd had Mateo Judd killed. The cop.
"Evening," Miller said.
"Detective Miller," the pocked man said. "I think we've gotten off on the wrong foot. I was hoping we could try again."
"Right.
May I come in?"
"I try not to take strange men home," Miller said. "I don't even know your name."
"Anderson Dawes," the pocked man said. "I'm the series liaison for the Outer Planets Alliance. I think we can help each other. May I come in?"
Miller stood back, and the pocked man, Dawes, stepped inside. Dawes took in the hole for the space of 2 slow breaths, then sat as if the bottles and the stink of old beer were nothing to comment on. Silently cursing himself and willing a sobriety he didn't feel, Miller sat across from him.
"I need a favor from you," Dawes said.
"I'm willing to pay you for it. Not money, of course.
Information."
"What do you want?" Miller asked.
"Stop looking for Juliet Mao."
"No sale."
"I'm trying to keep the peace, detective," Dawes said. "You should hear me out."
Miller leaned forward, elbows on the table. Mr. Serene, jiu-jitsu instructor, was working for the OPA. The timing of Dawes's visit seemed to be saying so. Miller filed that possibility away, but said nothing.
"Mao worked for us," Dawes said. "But you'd guess that."
"More or less. You know where she is?"
"We don't. We are looking for her. And we need to be the ones to find her. Not you."
Miller shook his head. There was a response, the right thing to say. It was rattling in the back of his head, and if he just didn't feel quite so fuzzy.
"You're one of them, detective. You may have lived your whole life out here, but your salary is paid by an inner planet corporation. No, wait, I don't blame you. I understand how it is. They were hiring, and you needed the work. But we're walking on a bubble right now. The Canterbury. The fringe elements in the belt calling for war."
"Phoebe Station."
"Yes. They'll blame us for that, too. Add a Luna Corporation's prodigal daughter."
"You think something's happened to her?"
"She was on the Scopuli," Dawes said. And when Miller didn't immediately respond, he added, "The freighter that Mars used as bait when they killed the Canterbury." Miller thought about that for a long moment, then whistled low.
"We don't know what happened," Dawes said. "Until we do, I can't have you stirring up the water. It's muddy enough now."
"And what information are you offering?" Miller asked.
"That's the trade, right?"
"I'll tell you what we find after we find her," Dawes said. Miller chuckled, and the OPA man went on. "It's a generous offer, considering who you are. Employee of Earth, partner of an Earther.
Some people would think that was enough to make you the enemy, too.
But not you, Miller said.
I think we've got the same basic goals, you and I. Stability. Safety. Strange times make for strange alliances.
Two questions. Dawes spread his arms, welcoming them. Who took the riot gear? Miller asked.
Riot's gear?
Before the Canterbury died, someone took our riot gear.
Maybe they wanted to arm soldiers for crowd control. Maybe they didn't want our crowds controlled.
Who took it?
Why?
It wasn't us, Dawes said. That's not an answer. Try this one. What happened to the Golden Bough Society?
Dawes looked blank.
Loka Grega? Miller asked. Sohiro? Dawes opened his mouth, closed it. Miller dropped his beer bottle into the recycler.
Nothing personal, friend, he said. But your investigative techniques aren't impressing me.
What makes you think you can find her?
It's not a fair test, Dawes said. Give me a few days. I'll get answers for you.
Talk to me, then. I'll try not to start an all-out war while you do, but I'm not letting go of Julie. You can go now.
Dawes rose. He looked sour.
You're making a mistake, he said.
Won't be my first.
After the man left, Miller sat at his table. He'd been stupid. Worse, he'd been self-indulgent, drinking himself into a stupor instead of doing the work, instead of finding Julie. But he knew more now. The scopuli, the Canterbury, more lines between the dots. He cleaned away his bottles, took a shower, and pulled up his terminal, searching what there was about Julie's ship. After an hour, a new thought occurred to him, a small fear that grew the more he looked at it. Near midnight, he put a call through to Havelock's Hole. His partner took 2 full minutes to answer. When he did, his image was wild-haired and bleary-eyed.
Miller?
Havelock. You have any vacation time saved up?
A little. Sick leave?
Sure, Havelock said.
Take it, Miller said. Take it now. Get off station. Someplace safe, if you can find it.
Someplace they're not going to start killing Earthers for shits and giggles if things go pear-shaped.
I don't understand. What are you talking about?
I had a little visit with an OPA agent tonight. He was trying to talk me into dropping my kidnap job.
I think he's nervous. I think he's scared.
Havelock was silent for a moment while the words filtered into his sleep-drunk mind.
Jesus, he said. Who scares the OPA?
Chapter 13. Holden. Holden froze, watching the blood pump from Shed's neck, then whip away like smoke into an exhaust fan. The sounds of combat began to fade as the air was sucked out of the room. His ears throbbed, and then hurt like someone had put ice picks in them. As he fought with his couch restraints, he glanced over at Alex. The pilot was yelling something, but it didn't carry through the thin air. Naomi and Amos had gotten off their couches already, kicked off, and were flying across the room to the 2 holes. Amos had a plastic dinner tray in one hand, Naomi a white 3-ring binder. Holden stared at them for the half-second it took to understand what they were doing. The world narrowed, his peripheral vision all stars and darkness. By the time he'd gotten free, Amos and Naomi had already covered the holes with their makeshift patches. The room was filled with a high-pitched whistle as the air tried to force its way out through the imperfect seals. Holden's sight began to return as the air pressure started to rise. He was panting hard, gasping for breath. Someone slowly turned the room's volume knob back up, and Naomi's yells for help became audible. "Jim, open the emergency locker," she screamed. She was pointing at a small red and yellow panel on the bulkhead near his crash couch. Years of shipboard training made a path through the anoxia and depressurization, and he yanked the tab on the locker's seal and pulled the door open. Inside were a white first aid kit marked with the ancient Red Cross symbol, half a dozen oxygen masks, and a sealed bag of hardened plastic discs attached to a glue gun. The emergency seal kit. He snatched it. "Just the gun," Naomi yelled at him. He wasn't sure if her voice sounded distant because of the thin air or because the pressure drop had blown his eardrums. Holden yanked the gun free from the bag of patches and threw it at her. She ran a bead of instant sealing glue around the edge of her three-ring binder. She tossed the gun to Amos, who caught it with an effortless backhand motion and put a seal around his dinner tray. The whistling stopped, replaced by the hiss of the atmosphere system as it labored to bring the pressure back up to normal. 15 seconds. Everyone looked at Shed. Without the vacuum, his blood was pouring out into a floating red sphere just above his neck, like a hideous cartoon replacement for his head. "Jesus Christ, boss," Amos said, looking away from Shed to Naomi. He snapped his teeth closed with an audible click and shook his head.
"What?"
"Gauss round," Alex said. "Those ships have railguns."
"Belt ships with railguns?" Amos said. "Did they get a fucking navy and no one told me?"
"Jim, the hallway outside and the cabin on the other side are both in vacuum," Naomi said. "The ship's compromised." Holden started to respond, then caught a good look at the binder Naomi had glued over the breech. The white cover was stamped with black letters that read, MCRN Emergency Procedures. He had to suppress a laugh that would almost certainly go manic on him. "Jim," Naomi said, her voice worried.
"I'm okay, Naomi,"
Holden replied, then took a deep breath.
"How long do those patches hold?"
Naomi shrugged with her hands, then started pulling her hair behind her head and tying it up with a red elastic band.
"Longer than the air will last. If everything around us is in vacuum, that means the cabin's running on emergency bottles. No recycling. I don't know how much each room has, but it won't be more than a couple hours."
"Kinda makes you wish we'd worn our fucking suits, don't it?" Amos asked.
"Wouldn't have mattered," Alex said. "We'd come over here in our enviro suits, they'd just have taken them away."
"Could have tried," Amos said.
"Well, if you'd like to go back in time and do it over, be my guest, partner."
Naomi sharply said, "Hey," but then nothing more. No one was talking about Shed. They were working hard not to look at the body. Holden cleared his throat to get everyone's attention, then floated to Shed's couch, drawing their eyes with him. He paused a moment, letting everyone get a good look at the decapitated body, then pulled a blanket from the storage drawer beneath the couch and strapped it down over Shed's body with the couch restraints. "Shed's been killed. We're in deep peril. Arguing won't extend our lives one second," Holden said, looking at each member of his crew in turn.
"What will?"
No one spoke. Holden turned to Naomi first.
"Naomi, what will keep us alive longer than we can do right now?" he asked.
"I'll see if I can find the emergency air. The room's built for six, and there are four of us. I might be able to turn the flow down and stretch it longer."
"Good. Thank you. Alex?"
"If there is anyone other than us, they'll be looking for survivors. I'll start pounding on the bulkhead. They won't hear it in the vacuum, but if there are cabins with air, the sound will travel down the metal.
Good plan. I refuse to believe we're the only ones left on this ship, Holden said, then turned to Amos. Amos?